You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where Brexit is the shit I take after breakfast. Thanks for stopping by this week, and if you enjoyed that joke and you enjoy your time in the midside, please, please tell a friend. Please, I'm looking at the camera for Welcome to the Meta Side. Tourism is our number. I'm just gonna keep this in there in the audio
tourism
too.
Tourism is our number one source of
references. Yeah.
I always tell my when I was teaching, I told my students when in doubt and they wanted to sound smart, just use a tautology. Well, when it rains, it rains.
Yeah. So referrals are our number one source of tourism here in the midside. That's what I was going for. We are fresh and relaxed, sort of, back from Austin, witnessing Daniel getting married. You may have seen about the 30-second Periscope I did. If you were on at the time, you weren't. We just had like three random people. It was quite an adventure, I'd say. So let's just go into it. Joining me this trip via Skype from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How does it feel to be married, Daniel?
A lot of people ask me that, and there is
no original, original and good questions here in the midside.
You were the only person ever to ask me that, and the only person, in fact, ever to think of that question in reference to a married man.
Thank you.
So congratulations.
Glad my brilliance has been acknowledged.
So fucking unique. You're the uniquest. There's actually a change, a certain emotional change that I felt. It's sort of a deep satisfaction mixed with a sense of relief. And the relief maybe is just mixed in with the stress of having to plan a party in Austin. But I don't know. I think there is some relief in like, yes, like we did it. It is a thing that is accomplished.
I hate to break it to you.
But the deep satisfaction comes from, obviously, you know, marrying the woman that I want to spend the rest of my life with.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Don't feel relief because there's 50% divorce rate in America. So it's not like, I'm so relieved she's never going to leave me now. No.
So you're Mrs. Nope. Daniel T. Richards now.
That's true. That's a mutual
that's
acquaintance of ours, Justin, Chris M., asked me if she took the tea. That was his only question.
What, did you reply that we're not in Boston, so she got here via a car?
Hilarious.
That was a good one.
That's a really local transit joke. I think our demographic will love the insider public transportation humor.
Speaking of public transportation, joining us via Skype from the hills of white privilege, James Elias. James took the bus and the train back to my apartment with me from LAX, and he did not enjoy that at all, did you, James?
No, I come from the hills of white privilege. We drive our own individual cars. Look, the human body has a bloodstream, and it has these little cells, and they got to go wherever the tide pushes them. Why? Because the purpose of blood is the sustenance of man's life. So they have to just go on this mass transit. But the purpose of an individual man's life is himself. So he's got to have his own individual car to go wherever he wants. He doesn't have to be pushed along with the tide of all the other people. We're not taking mass transit ever again. It's like morally wrong. It's against the fabric of my moral being.
A biological refutation of public transit. You heard it here first, folks.
Except I disagree with the premise. It brought me to where I needed to go.
Yeah, but you got there slowly and inefficiently. But and also you were with other people, which is the worst.
It's better than that fucking $20 shuttle full of Mexican families to and from the airport. I will take the train and the plane and the automobile any day over a $20 shuttle full of Mexican families to and from the airport.
Well, as someone who must take public transportation every day, I do have to side with James on this. It is pretty much the worst thing I do on a daily basis. And it used to be, used to say, well, at least it's safer because cars are the most dangerous thing we do. Except that the DC Metro has proven to be horribly unsafe. In fact, on my way home today, the Metro was on fire again. It is on fire so much that there is a website, ismetroonfire.com, to let you know. And it averages about 4 times a week that it is on fire.
So, is that like, did Marty McFly travel back from the past today, that website?
Yes, indeed. All it says is yes or no. And if it's yes, it tells you which lines are on fire.
All of them!
So.
Well, according to what you've been saying, that may be an eventuality given the how little they do about a potential terrorist threat on that line. They got their heads up their asses. They're not looking at the screens. They're looking at the inside of their own rectum.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Oh, public transit, how I loathe thee.
All right, let's talk about more things that have to deal with the public and people having discussed for it, even if it makes sense or not. Does that sound good?
Perfect.
That transition works with anything, by the way. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad. 'Cause kid, there's consequences to what we say and what we do.
Brexit! Unless you live in a cave in Afghanistan, you've probably heard by now that the British electorate decided to leave the European Union through a nationwide referendum. And Time magazine has an article in the World UK section. The Brexit vote is a new milestone in the global war on elites. Yes, the global war on elites. Quote, in a sense, the result of this referendum is a victory for Trumpism the world over. Basically, the crux of this article is that this is a repudiation of our, you know, global elite masters, bankers, big business, career politicians. But it is in
the Illuminati.
The Illuminati, the Bilderbergs, all those folks. But the core sort of underlying premise that they have here is that repudiation is necessarily the Donald Trump kind of repudiation, where it's based on xenophobia, racism, a new nationalism, the idea that we're losing, that Britain in this case is losing its national identity because of those evil immigrants, and thus it is a horrible, bad thing. For anyone who doesn't know, by the way, the vote ended up being 52% to 48%. Which means that the margin of victory for the Leave team was around 1.3 million voters. So while you might think 52 to 48 is close, keep that in mind. It was 1.3 million more people endorsed the Leave campaign. So we wanted to talk about Brexit in a couple ways. One is, of course, to answer this article, is Brexit or is this sort of move sort of anti-establishment in the Donald Trump sense? Is it anti-establishment in a good sense? In general, is this a bad thing?
I have a question.
And then one, hold on. The second point would be, is there some sort of Brexit-y movement that the United States can have either with the UN or some people have talked about a Texit movement? You know, can Texas secede from the nation, et cetera? So go right ahead.
That's what I just said on Welcome to the Meta Side, by the way. I paused it and I said, wait, it's my show. I mean, I muted my mic, but no, I just got annoyed. Like, my question went out the window because people are really saying Texit. Like, just because, there's an X in there too. Maybe they can do it too. Like, we call it seceding here in America. Fuck you. All right?
I don't think you want to call it seceding because that's too associated with, you know, the Confederacy and like saying we want to keep slavery, as opposed to what Texas would be doing would be avoiding slavery when seceding. So it would be nice to have a different name for it. That being said, I fucking hate the word Brexit or exit or all of this shit.
Well, you just argued in favor of changing a word because of package dealing. Based upon that logic, we should never use the word selfish. I win. I just smacked you down big time.
Package deal. Saying
you just package deal secession. You just package deal secession.
That's okay, because that was an actual historical movement that had to do with slavery.
That was one application of the term secession, and you're package dealing it and saying all applications of the term secession mean that. I win. You can't argue with that. Daniel, agree or disagree?
I love how I get to be the arbiter of reality. I don't know how I got to this position in my life.
That's what everyone said at the wedding. That's what everyone in their fucking speeches said, so that's your position now. That's all I heard. That's all I heard is I heard Daniel is the smartest person here, and he has the hugest dick in the world, so go.
Well, so, I mean, I side a little bit with Justin, but I'm not. The rhetorical point is a good one, actually, which is that even if secession is the correct term, you shouldn't necessarily use it because it has weird connotations.
All right, you guys just opened up a large door. That's all I'm saying.
I opened up the trog door. That's what I heard.
Trog door! If I could draw a trog door. Yeah, he'd be on my whiteboard. Okay, now here's the question I have. Is it Brexit or Brexit? How do you say it correctly?
Well, it's like the word exit, but with bruh at the front. Brexit.
Bruh.
Okay, that's what I thought I said, but then you were saying it differently. All right.
What? All right. Well, I'm just saying it quickly. It's So,
let's say something relevant so people think we have a good show.
Yes. Well, that's going to be impossible at this point. But here's the primary question to you two, first of all. Let's just go with a really simple one. Do you think the British electorate made the right call in leaving the European Union? Why or why not? Go.
Go ahead, James.
I have no answer to this question. I just simply do not understand the politics well enough. In general, I tend to say yes, they made the right decision based on the broad knowledge that England is one of the least corrupted countries of the European Union, so it's good that it will be making its own decisions instead of being dragged down by some of the lesser countries of the European Union. That being said, I don't know what their motives were. This could be completely on track for all I know. It's sort of an anti-establishment sort of, you know, feeling that's like, hey, we need to rebel in some kind of vague way, but we don't really know how to do it. We can't do it in any fundamental way. So let's vote for Trump or let's Brexit. You know, I feel like this is not essential. This is not something that is any kind of essential issue for the long-term political state of the West. And so I don't have much of a position on it. That being said, I'm very impressed with the Prime Minister actually resigning his post on the idea that the people want a policy that's fundamentally different from his strategy. And so he's basically saying, like, he's making this incredibly logical decision for a politician where he's saying, oh, hey, like, the electorate wants something completely different than I'm offering, so I guess I'll just resign and let someone else do this job. Like, what am I in the Twilight Zone where politicians are fucking reasonable for a change? What's going on? I'm sure I'm misunderstanding this. I'm sure, like, you know, he's actually banging dudes in the back or something, and he just doesn't want that to get out. And so someone blackmailed him, you know. I don't know. That's what it seems like.
That's actually The Onion had an article basically reflecting your sentiment, by the way.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when I saw this.
The Onion headline is, Americans confused by system of government in which leader would resign after making terrible decision.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yes. Not that he necessarily made a terrible decision, but...
Yeah, I didn't get that. He didn't make a bad decision. He's just not in line with the will of the people. So he's just saying, hey, someone else do this job because clearly they don't want me.
Yeah, but it's not as funny as a headline. So The Onion wrote the headline the way they did.
They could have wrote it some other way.
Government official resigns because people disagree with him is not funny.
Right.
Although it would be sort of funny weird in modern context. But Justin, do you have a... Brexit opinion?
Well, thank you for pronouncing it correctly, so I'm not confused anymore. So because England lost to Iceland today 2-1, I think that objectively proves the universe wanted them to stay in the European Union. Otherwise, they wouldn't have lost the game. I mean, they're so full of malaise that the team couldn't even get up to beat Iceland. That's a problem if you can't beat Iceland. No,
beat
all
them in what?
In what? You
in a world
fucking
war?
Americans. It's the European Soccer Championships right now. Only the second most important tournament behind the World Cup. Come on.
And what was the score? Like, what did you say, 2-1? And that took 90 minutes to score 3 points collectively? Excellent.
Baseball games are sometimes longer than that, and 1-0 or 2-1. So America's pastime.
You're not
going to
see me defending baseball. Baseball is the stupidest fucking American sport.
I love how James had this awesome analysis, and now we're arguing about baseball and soccer. this is what I think. It was so obvious to me that was like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. That's normal. That when people were outraged by this, I was like, what are they upset about? To me, this is a vote for English sovereignty. Because here's the difference between like the United States of America and the European Union. We were founded as one country. I mean, I know we had the colonies first and everything, but all of the culture was basically the same. And now, obviously, we can make an argument going forward. Are the cultures so disparate within the different states that, yeah, we can break apart and secede? We can make that argument. But in the case of the European Union, yes, these countries are too disparate. They do have two different of cultures. I think this was a good move for England. This is a good news for the people who live there because it allows them to express their sovereignty. It's a vote for independence, which hopefully will trickle down into individualism for the country. And wasn't this also largely motivated by the fact of all the fucking Muslim immigrants that are coming in and causing fucking problems? I mean, haven't we been saying, or at least I've been saying, that England is like America in the future, where if we keep going with this politically correct bullshit, that's what's going to happen to us? Well, now we see there's actually a backlash in England against it, so maybe we can, you know, take the foreshadowing and have our backlash beforehand so we don't get that far?
Yeah, so Nigel Farage, who's the leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, which is sort of like the Libertarian Party, except that they're like Libertarian Party with the sort of Trump protectionist part, which is kind of weird. But he has been one of the leading campaigners in this, and his major issue is the sort of Muslim immigration issue. Which is why I'm sort of mixed bag on Brexit. Brexit. I think for the most part, it's going to be a good thing. They're going to have to deal with fewer regulatory burdens, fewer government from afar, i.e., Brussels, who puts together, especially these regulations on businesses that typically make absolutely no sense for the British people.
By the way, how did fucking Brussels become the center of the European Union? Like, were they just like a random country? So Belgium doesn't do anything except make kind of good chocolate. So we'll give them the European Union. That'll make them feel better.
Well, it was because it probably would have been London, except that Britain has always been sort of this really reluctant, dragged along partner into the EU. Like, they didn't really want to be part of it. Like, never adopted the Euro standard. Like, they've just sort of been like, okay, I guess this is whatever. If they'd sort of been gung-ho about it, I bet it would have been London, but maybe I'm wrong.
You sound like you're from London.
Thank you. Good reference. But, oh, what was I going to say? Oh, so the immigration part of it, this is the part that I think reasonable people differ on the most, which is, in a lot of ways, Britain is going to be more free because of getting out of the EU, but restrictions on immigration are going to be greater. And so right now there's free immigration among all European Union countries, but Britain wants to not have that continue. That's part of the reason this was passed. Do you think does this increase the cause of freedom? Is it a good thing that there are going to be immigration restrictions? I sort of have a mixed view on this, as do a couple of other libertarians like Ilya Soman, writing at The Vol Conspiracy, who thinks that restrictions on immigrations are ultimately going to lead to less freedom for the British people. Justin, I know within the United States, you think there should probably be some legitimate restrictions on immigration.
Well, I mean, that's what I was just going to say, is that's the exact same argument that I was making before. And what's his name? Stefan Molyneux is a big he makes this argument a lot, too. And he's definitely, you know, I mean, he's an anarchist, isn't he, James?
Yeah, he's yeah. the worst kind of anarchist.
Okay, well, he's the worst kind of anarchist. I don't know. I don't know what the fuck that means. But they're all the same to me. They all just are all on motorcycles and they kill each other over the drug trade. That's what I learned from television about anarchy. No, it's the same argument he makes. Is it's just like when you have when the culture of the world is so fucked up, right, that the people you're letting in are destroying what's good about your country, how can you have open immigration? It seems to me that, and I'm just saying this off the cuff so nobody be like, oh, that's a philosophically untenable position. It seems to me that maybe immigration is the last thing you do. It's like once everything else is good and it's like, okay, you're good. We're good here. Is everyone else's country good? You know, you got rid of all the fucked up stuff. Okay, now let's open our borders. But it seems like if you open your borders when there's a lot of fucked up shit going around, all you're doing is allowing the, you know, fucked up shit to come in. I mean, think of it like a disease, right? You don't say, oh, well, I want a world where everyone can be together all the time and they have a disease that needs to be quarantined, but we're not going to quarantine them because we're against keeping people in separate areas. It's kind of like, at what point is the culture so bad that it needs to be quarantined? Because I'm to the point that, like, if you want to go into a club and shoot up gay people because, you know, you don't like them, like, and your culture says kill the infidels, then maybe you should be quarantined? Maybe?
Quarantining Islam. That's the new James Patterson book, I feel like. But here's my issue with that in general. I have some sympathy to it because I'm not a cultural relativist, clearly. But at the same time, it's like if our culture is so terrible that we can't reject the bad things about these cultures coming in, we can't have moral fortitude about it, we can't decide that we want to fight or we want to stop this existential threat, or so bad that we're influenced by horrible ideas that come into this country. Let's not say they're violent, but they're just horrible ideas that are sort of anti-life, anti-human, etc. Then what is our culture really worth? What are we trying to protect? And if we lock ourselves down, what is that going to do? It's not like it's going to make us any better as a culture. Our culture's still going to be shitty.
I just want to say that you sound like a villain in the Dark Knight trilogy right now.
Which one?
That's my point. All of them wanted to destroy Gotham because they said we're no better than the masked freaks. You know, because we needed the Batman, that means there are going to be more masked freaks. And then, you know, the Joker was anarchy and wanted to just watch the world burn because Gotham was so irrational. And, you know, he wanted to prove that the best was irrational when he did it with Harvey Dent, what he did with Two-Face. And then along came Bane in the third one, who was like, yeah, it's so fucked up. I just need to control everything. And it wasn't really Bane. It was, you know, I'm not going to go with the spoiler, but you know what? You get the point I'm making. It all came back to the League of Assassins saying Gotham needed to be destroyed to be rebuilt because it was beyond saving.
Well, I mean, maybe that's interpretation of what I'm saying. I'm not saying that our culture needs to burn to the ground because it's so bad. My point is,
what the fuck was that?
That was Justin's attempt at an impression. Which is why we see he doesn't do them regularly.
Kermit D. Frog here.
Yeah, that's like a 2 out of 10, and that's the best. But my point is not that if our culture is bad, it should be destroyed or that it's moral equivalent. My point is, if the idea is that we're fighting a cultural war and we need to stop bad culture from coming in, well, wouldn't the ultimate strong culture war being basically allow these people in and have such a strong culture that we convert them, or we have them, you know, see a new light because of how strong our cultural presence is? But the problem is, it's not. As we talked about a couple weeks ago, if politics is downstream of culture, then what the fuck does that say about our culture right now?
So now I just heard you argue for the purge. That's what I just heard.
The purge is a stupid premise and has nothing to do with what Daniel just said.
He just said let them in and then we'll take care of them. That sounds like the purge to me.
No, he said let's try to change them. I mean,
through murder.
Daniel, you make a really good point. But something, you make a really good point. I'm undecided on this issue, but I think something that has to weigh upon our decision. By the way, if you are an objectivist and have been living under a rock, in other words, not talking to other objectivists, basically, this is a huge debate within the objectivist community.
Apparently, I've been living under a rock. Thank you.
Oh yeah, you didn't know that, Justin? But
I don't pay attention to them.
It's a big debate on HBL and stuff like that, and
JML
forums like that. No, HBL, the Harry Binsley. There are other MLs, you know, like milliliter. Anyway, so it's a big debate within the objectivist community, and I really like arguments on both sides of it. I haven't made up my mind, but here's something that absolutely has to play on our decision. As an objectivist community, if you're part of it, or even if you're part of the libertarian community, you got to realize that our influence is not political yet. Our influence is mainly intellectual. And we cannot affect, and this means you too, libertarians, we don't affect policy yet. I know you want to, you know, pretend that we do and have that la-la land. We don't affect policy yet. The culture is not yet on our side. So what that means is that our rhetoric, I would tend to think, has to advocate for the ideal, not for whatever we think is going to get us out of this particular situation. We have to advocate for the ideal foreign policy as a way of communicating the broader context of liberty to the rest of the culture in order to change it. That means we don't necessarily offer specific solutions to how to get out of the shit show we're in right now. It means that we project what we see the ideal as. That being said, I don't know if the ideal means we have open borders or not, because I hear a lot of people giving very good arguments that even in a perfectly objectivist society, we would still be wary of outside philosophic influences over our culture. I think at the very least, there's suspicion in letting them in and just voting. One thing I think of is let as many in as they want, but they don't get to vote.
Well, yeah, I mean, not just
citizens. Make it really hard. Make it so you got to be a citizen to vote. Make it really hard to become a citizen.
Actually, by the way, before I let Justin speak on his own show again, I'm actually very sympathetic to that view. But I take it further, which is I don't think if you are born here, you should automatically be given citizenship or the right to vote. You should have to make a positive affirmation that you want to become a citizen of the country that you're born in. Whatever that means.
Yeah, you should have to pass a reading test to be able to vote.
And pay a poll tax and own property and be a white man.
Yeah.
But other than that, you can vote.
I'm being facetious, but I actually agree that you should have to reach a certain threshold to vote as well. Because one of the things people don't realize is the reason voting worked decently in the beginning of the country is because, like, most of the people were educated. The reason it doesn't work now is because most of the people aren't educated. But beyond the
voters were educated.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm saying most of the citizens were educated. There was a smaller amount of citizens and a higher percentage of them were educated.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is why in the beginning education was such a value for this country because, you know, it was easier to educate people.
Yeah, but Justin, if you stopped stupid people from voting and only allowed the more intellectual to vote, we would be a communist country right now.
Obviously, you're assuming they meet my standard of smart.
Yeah, I know, but like the more elite people tend to be the more intellectual in this country, and unfortunately, the intellectuals are anti-American.
Well, I would also call them anti-intellectual as well, but that's a different discussion.
That's true, but they're the ones in the universities and holding the intellectual positions. Unfortunately,
I'm in complete agreement with you. That's why I didn't want to get sidetracked by that. That was just
right,
a
right,
note.
Right, 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 right.
Well, what was I going to respond to? Oh, I remember what I was going to respond to. We're off the rails now. We've done so many minutes on this story. We might have to cut a news story here, Daniel.
I'm happy to cut a news story.
What I was going to say is it's not just the philosophical threats either. Like, I mean, just from a purely pragmatic point of view, you can't have completely open borders. And what I mean by that is I'm going to go back to the disease thing. You can't fucking let people with diseases into this country. And what I mean by that is if somebody has the plague and they're coming into this country, you got to fucking stop them at the border. So you need some sort of border guards.
Yeah. And to be fair to even open borders people, I think even the most strident open border people, barring anarchists, would argue that a rational government can stop people who have diseases, who can stop people who have severe criminal records or who are known terrorists.
Mentally unstable.
Yeah, but it's basically the idea of barring any of that, barring immediate or potential existential threats, there should be completely open borders.
That's right, the open so the question then arguing. Becomes, and this is the this that's be, what you've just elucidated, Daniel, is the question I have.
Elucidated? Indicated? Elucidated? Elucidated?
No, that's a fucking word. Look it up.
Elucidated?
Look it up!
Not a word.
My phone is filming right now, so I cannot use it because it's on airplane mode. I'm going to look it up.
Elucidated? You mean elucidate, not elucidate.
Fine, I meant elucidate. I don't know. Whatever. Eliminate. What you've just eliminated, Daniel. Eliminated in your early 2000s late night dating shows that Justin Rourke watched in college because he couldn't get laid, is the question I have. And the question is, where is the line between an imminent threat? Because that's basically what we're saying. Like, all of these things we just named are imminent threats to the people who live there. Are people who their culture is so deranged imminent threats or not? And that's the question I have, and that's what I can't answer.
To me, that's not an imminent threat, because that requires persuasion. That requires you to take your shitty culture and persuade people in what should be a better culture that your shitty culture is superior.
Was the guy in Orlando trying to persuade people?
No, well, first of all, Justin, he was born here. First of all, by the way, let's not forget that he was born in the United States.
His parents were not born here.
No, but his parents didn't kill people at a nightclub.
No, but they advocated for Islam.
They did, but again, advocating for Islam is different from killing people with a gun.
Some people might disagree with that, and that's the question I have. I'm not saying I have a stance on it. I'm just saying that after all the arguments that were presented on our last episode about how Islam is based upon being like the Prophet Muhammad, who is about violence, to me, there's a very thin line there. And that's all I'm asking is, where is the line and how thin is it? Where must the line be drawn, Picard?
Yes.
Do I have to break my little ships to make my point?
Here is the line. And again, in our hypothetical, let's not devolve the hypothetical. We're talking about like a free society that has a rational, good culture, right? Uh-huh. Otherwise, because if we're talking about a current culture, it's fucked and there's no answer. But in a rational culture, like, what is the best? Like James was talking about earlier, I don't think you can even stop an ideology from coming in like Islam, because there are people, again, specific Muslims, who don't follow the violent parts of Islam, who reject the violent parts of Islam, basically two interpretations of Islam. Even if you say that Islam in and of itself may be an inherently violent religion, there are specific Muslims who reject that, so you have to base that on the specific person.
So then call yourself like Muslim light, like you're Muslim before you bought the in-app purchases of violence.
You're the freemium version of Muslim,
right?
Of Islam,
because you're rejecting part of it. Don't call yourself the same thing as it.
Well, that's a good question, and that's a thing for Islam as a religion and a culture to take up, whether or not it should, you know, further fragment or macro fragment. I'm now getting into words that only make sense in my head.
Elucidate.
But I don't think in a rational society, in a free society that has a strong culture, you would reject even those people because they're not existential threats. They preach a bad ideology or an ideology that you would think is irrational, but irrationality per se is not an existential threat to a strong culture.
And even if it was, let's remember a little thing called the First Amendment. Maybe you heard of it.
Absolutely.
If we're getting rid of the Second Amendment, let's just take the First with it. That's all I'm saying.
Dude, you know what? I'm I am a huge proponent. I think we should really bring back a lot of advocacy for the Fourth Amendment. I mean, get those soldiers out of our houses. That's a huge deal to me.
Yeah, so speaking of other amendments, the second one was under attack this week. And by the way, James, please put that microphone, just jam it right in your face. Just just like you're going down on that microphone. Just get right up in there. Much better. Much better. The second
that was a little too close. That was a little too close to what it was like, what it would be like for James to give me a blowjob for me to be comfortable with that.
But from across the room, to be fair, at least, maybe across the state.
I mean, you got to be across the room for me to give me a blowjob.
Oh, God. Oh, okay. Jesus.
You walked into that one.
Democrats.
Get it?
Literally. Yeah. House Democrats ended their sit-in demanding votes on gun control legislation after almost 26 hours.
Plus, he's only 26.
It was a rare event seeing members of Congress seated on the floor in suits, skirts, and blankets, all trying to force votes on measurements after the largest mass shooting in our nation's recent history. I love the phrasing of that by ABC News, by the way. The largest mass shooting in our nation's recent history.
I actually enjoyed that because my biggest argument about like the mass shooting thing was like, what about the Civil War? Wasn't that a bigger mass shooting than what happened?
Different kind of thing, but you could say like...
Let's just shred and smush concepts together until everything is everything else. You know what I did today? I ate sausages and some Korean ribs. That was a mass shooting.
All I'm saying, James, is what you said about secession.
Okay. All right. Both of you, shut up. Okay. During the hours of sitting and talking on the floor, House Democrats said they wanted votes on two measures that may sound familiar to those following politics this week. One, to stop people on terror watch lists from purchasing guns, and two, to expand mandatory background checks to firearm purchases at gun shows and online. They may sound familiar because both of these measures failed in the Senate earlier this week, and the political fate will likely have no different result in the House. So what did the Democrats actually accomplish with their sit-in? Other than looking like, I don't know, babies has been an apt comparison.
Babies.
Just savages sitting there just passing a watermelon around. Like, yeah, let's get this policy. Pass the weed.
Okay. Got to be careful with that watermelon reference there. Yeah. James FaceTime.
Because one of the biggest. Yeah, wasn't the guy who ran the whole thing black?
Yeah, Representative John Lewis. Absolutely. So yeah. We're going to go ahead and edit that part out.
No, I'm not editing that out because it makes James look bad, which makes me look better.
No, it doesn't. James is innocently racist. It's perfectly fine. So
I was going for like a savage thing. Like they're a bunch of like, you know.
Wait, so black people are savages and they eat watermelon? Is that what you're saying?
Wow. Derailed.
I'm imagining a bunch of, okay, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a racist. Fine. I'm owning it. Donald Trump, 2016.
But there is, in fact, a sort of ironic or twisted sort of turn of events here where this is like a sit-in sort of representative or, sorry, sort of evocative of the sit-ins during the Civil Rights era. And with Civil Rights icon, Representative John Lewis, who is leading this, saying, "We must never give up or give in," and they were actually chanting, "We will overcome," on the Senate floor, or on the House floor, sorry. Is there not some deep irony here that sit-ins used to be about securing rights, and now sit-ins are about taking away rights? Like, does no one see the horrible irony of that?
No, a lot of people on Twitter saw that irony.
Well, I don't go on Twitter, so.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
That's good.
The thing is that regardless of whether you're championing a correct cause, as they did with race against racism, or an incorrect cause, as they're doing now, what the fuck is a sit-in? A sit-in is not a fucking argument. Like, it just shows the intellectual bankruptcy of the left, that it's just like they've given up on using reason. We're not going to educate people about how, you know, the color of skin has nothing to do with
liking watermelon.
With whether you eat watermelon or not, whether you know, it's no one's bothering to do this anymore. No one's bothering to debate anymore. Like, soon we're just going to be communicating with, like, I'm going to shit in my hat and hand it to you and say, like, vote for Hillary. Like, and that's supposed to mean something.
That's the equivalent of an argument for voting for Hillary.
That's actually the most compelling argument I've heard.
Yeah.
Voting for Hillary. But...
No, James, what you're talking about here is a misapplication of the principle of a sit-in or a boycott. In democracy, the reason a sit-in or a boycott developed is to show that the voting populace, the majority, is out of line with the government. So it's basically another way of voting, is what I'm saying, is you get as many fucking people together as you can to show, hey, look, there are many people who disagree with this, even though the government's going in a different direction. But you're already in the fucking government. You're not doing it. Like, doing the sit-in isn't going to accomplish anything. You're forgetting your role. You're acting like you're fucking... The reason they're doing this is they're acting like they're the oppressed ones. And they're acting like they're the ones whose voices aren't heard.
I mean, but the sit-ins were conducted in restaurants, not in public places like courtrooms or you know, Senate chambers. They were literally people... just trespassing on a business owner's property, and because of some kind of, you know, because they were associated with a just cause, we now allow people of any kind of political persuasion to do this, as long as it's leftist, actually. And the fact that that's force and you are overwhelming someone's restaurant against their will, you know, that's sort of lost on people, and you know that you are violating someone's right to do with your property what you wish.
Yeah, I wasn't defending the sit-in as a technique. I was simply explaining where it comes from and why it's fucking retarded the government is using it.
Yeah, you're wrong.
It's just become so automatic for James to say that.
Secession.
The other sort of bizarre thing here is what they're holding a sit-in for, what they're trying to advocate for. The one you could say that might have some validity, despite the fact that I strongly disagree with it, you know, the expanded mandatory background checks at gun shows and online, fine, whatever. But the one that made the most news, the one they were sort of really up in arms about, was stopping people on the terrorist watch list from purchasing guns. Isn't this a core violation of the Second Amendment? Because what is the quote-unquote due process for being put on the list? Some government official, likely in Homeland Security or the FBI, thinks you're a terrorist, and therefore you go on this list.
Well, this is ironic because when Bush...
That's the exact opposite.
Right. When Bush passed the Patriot Act, this is what you're saying, Daniel, here's another application of it, they were up in arms about it because it was a violation of civil liberties. But now they're doing another thing that could basically be part of the Patriot Act, and they think it's a good thing.
Right. If you think that being put on the list in and of itself is a violation of your civil rights because there is no due process, then being put on the list and having a right that is guaranteed to you by the Constitution or secured by the Constitution taken away because you're on that list should be an extra level of offensive to them.
But yeah, but I mean, but Justin or Daniel, you're applying the idea of consistency and logic to the left's policies. That's where you went wrong here.
God damn it, again?
I mean,
this
is a quip, of course, that I'm making, but I think there's a larger lesson to be sort of learned from this. I've kind of been, over the last few podcasts, I've sort of been inching towards this, and I think... I'm starting to think a change in strategy has to be made when dealing with the left. It's no longer appropriate. I don't think it's appropriate at all, in fact, anymore, to point out the ways in which the left is incorrect. We now, instead of pointing out just, you know, sort of very matter-of-factly demonstrating how their argument is wrong, their arguments should not be treated as arguments anymore. They should be treated as deceptions, basically. And instead of refuting them, we should simply... explain how they are deceptions and what their illegitimate vicious motives are. And this is an idea I'm sort of playing with for a sort of a political strategy to beat the left. And
I mean, that's kind of what we're doing. I don't disagree with you, but I mean, we're just kind of fucking mocking it for being stupid. We're not taking them seriously. We're just like saying, haha, look how stupid their argument is for being contradictory.
Right.
That's what we're saying.
But I'm saying that idea of mocking them and not taking them seriously can be taken even further into the level of an actual political rhetorical strategy And maybe I'll write, maybe if you'll let me, Justin, or if it's cool with you, I might actually put an article up on the Midside on this. I just wrote,
yes,
the laundry list for it actually just before the show.
Now accepting content submissions on the midside.com.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, if there's one other concept that needs to be mocked this week, it is certainly one that I have had my run-in with lately, which is adulting. Which, by the way, the Democrat representatives were not doing, sitting on the House floor.
Like a bunch of children.
But a woman named Danielle Tullo over at Cosmopolitan. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Midside is reading a Cosmo article.
Yeah, you just that's my question I want to ask you, Daniels. How do you feel that Cosmo agrees with you?
Oh, man, I don't know. It's
and not just agrees with us, but agrees on a very deep level, too. This has, like, real, like, philosophic unpackaging going on in this article.
It's true. So the article is titled, "Kindly Shut the Hell Up About Adulting." And the subtitle is, "Adulting, Also Known as Existing," which I found as a cute little jab. But so the woman starts out explaining, she's scrolling through Twitter and she sees all these tweets about from millennials essentially talking about adulting because, you know, she cooked dinner or she paid her taxes or whatever it is. She goes in to give Urban Dictionary's definition of adulting, which is, by the way, quote, to do grown up things and hold responsibilities such as a 9-to-5 job, a mortgage / rent, a car payment, or anything else that makes one think of grown ups. And she cites that in the past year, the term adulting has increased in usage by 700% on Twitter. And now it's so mainstream that brands like Reese's are using it to reach millennials. So here's where she starts to get into some interesting unpackaging of what's going on here. She says adulting is a terrible fake word that everyone should stop using. Adulting implies that being an adult is not a necessary part of growing up, but rather a life choice you're hesitant to fully buy into. It's a singularly millennial, especially female, that immaturity that reduces being a grown-up to a hobby. If nothing else you do makes you seem like a stereotypical millennial living in an entitled fantasy land where actually growing up is like your hobby's optional, saying adulting is sure to do just that.
There's so much to say about that, isn't there? I mean, it could go in so many different directions.
Yeah, you could. First and foremost here, I think this is something that has been sort of culturally going on for a long time, which is the rejection of adulthood and the raising up and putting on a pedestal childhood, that childhood is somehow better than being an adult. This is something that I have had no emotional connection to ever in my entire life. Since the moment I could conceptualize what an adult was versus what I was, I wanted to be an adult. I had no interest in ever being a child. I learned to read early on, not just these children's books, but I was reading parts of the Wall Street Journal because I was much more interested in being an adult than I was in being a child.
I agree with what you're saying, but this is sort of like, there's an irony here though, because they've given up on being an adult pragmatically, like in the day-to-day things they have to do, right? That's what they've given up on. And they're saying, but they've become an adult in the sense of the cynicism and the bitterness, and they've given up on their hopes and dreams as well. And their idea of being a child is just sort of like hedonism almost. And that's even a benevolent interpretation. It's just sort of like whatever the next pleasure is for the next day, live for the next moment type of idea, rather than living for any long-term goal and dreaming. Because one of the things that drew me to objectivism and one of the things that drew me to Ayn Rand's philosophy is the idea of never giving up that childlike wonder about the world and the desire to succeed and be a heroic being and achieve. So there's an irony there, where on one hand, you know, they say people like us have given up on childhood because, you know, we grew up and like we, well, I've kind of grown up, but you get my point. I'm surrounded by action figures right now, but that's a different point. Welcome to the Metaside viewers. Don't stop mocking me on the other side of YouTube. So we've grown up in a certain way, but we also haven't grown up in a certain way because we realize that growing up doesn't mean giving that up. But then on the other hand, these people haven't grown up in a certain way, but on the other side, they've grown up in the cultural stereotype of growing up, of, you know, becoming cynical and bitter about the world and, you know, just taking your 9-to-5 and giving into the man type deal. And I think that's part of why they do that.
Yeah, I definitely think part of the attack on adulthood is what would be making a straw man out of adulthood, almost. You know, yes. Adulthood means having a job you hate and marrying a woman you don't love and having children that you don't particularly care for and owning a home that costs too much and a car that is a minivan that you have to pay for. And thus, why would you want to be an adult? So, well, that's not adulthood per se, and it's certainly not the life you should want for yourself, unless whatever reason it is the life you want for yourself. But I think our view of adulthood used to be more like what we consider now, like you said, ironically, the sort of sense of wonder and exploration and having all these great privileges and good times and being able to fully enjoy life. Now we ascribe that to children, which is bizarre to me because I'd never had that emotional experience. But James, what do you think about this, the philosophical stuff she brings in here? Later on, she talks a little bit about how, you know, the concept of adulting actually is incredibly detrimental to thinking about how you achieve things in the world and thinking about how you accomplish things in your career. The example she points out is a friend named Kara, who is incredibly talented, landed a dream job in the entertainment industry, but she wouldn't know any of this because the only thing she ever promotes are things like, I made lunch today, #adulting, where you think that that's sort of impressive achievement, where her life is incredibly more impressive than that. Like, the things she's accomplished are incredibly better than making lunch, but you don't hear about them because she's too busy promoting adulting.
After James goes, I have a point to follow up with what you're saying. So go ahead, James.
So this Kara who is adulting, you know, the thing is that when I would have no problem with this hashtag if it was used by 18-year-olds, because I remember when I was 12, I started cooking my own food. I'm like, and I didn't have the word adulting, but I'm like, I had this certain sense of pride where I'm like, okay, I'm learning to start to take care of myself. And then I was like 16, I started doing my own laundry, and you know, bit by bit, I start accepting, you know, the responsibilities of taking care of myself, and each transition was met with a little bit of not fear, but like sort of a sense of like, I need to make sure I do this right. I got to make sure I get used to this. This is a, you know, this is serious shit. This is important. If she's an actress and getting all these good things done, it's also an achievement to just being a self-sustaining human being. I think that's fine. I think what the author really identifies here is the idea that adulting is not a requirement, but rather a lifestyle choice. I think something that makes, I don't think millennials are lazy per se, at least calling them lazy as a subculture, calling them lazy is a little bit too, superficial. It's deeper than that. It's this idea that I am a millennial myself. There's something about our generation that we're against having a specific identity. Like, if I am an adult, that means I can now not be a kid. If I am a man, that means there are all these responsibilities. I have to be assertive. I have to, you know, be the one to talk to women. And so maybe I feel like I'm a woman instead. I think what it is we're afraid of identity. And so one thing is adulting. That is something that, you know, it comes with these responsibilities. And so you're making a big deal out of it. Like, oh, I'm adulting, lol. That means I'm kind of, you know, submitting to this, you know, sort of identity, which we all know is a little bit silly. That's the implicit tone we hear when anyone uses this phrase.
You're being far too benevolent. I agree with what you identified up until the point that you said it's about.
I'm being much more malevolent than if I was accusing millennials of being lazy. This is a fundamental attack on identity, on saying like, I am a such, I am this, I have these certain responsibilities. It's shirking the responsibility, and with adulting, you're playing off the responsibilities of sustaining your life itself.
Okay, so, you've said the right word when you've said responsibility. You're right. Yeah. You're right in that identity is a casualty here. I agree with you 100% that identity is a casualty here because people are not going to be able to develop identity because of the mentality they have. But the key word you just said there is responsibilities, and you said shirking responsibilities because to fold a little bit of MRA in here, notice how Daniel said that it's identified that it's often women who are saying this, right? This is because we have a generation of people who are raised on entitlement, who were raised on their parents doing everything for them, the government doing everything for them, so they didn't have to grow up. Daniel, isn't this something Adam Carolla talks about on his show, that people were out working in the factories and dying at a certain age, that they're not even doing that now when they get beyond that age?
Yeah, I mean, one of the themes is that we're constantly sort of moving away from hard work or existential threats, like, you know, being chased by lions, working in a factory, 9-to-5 job. Now kids are going to have to do that because their parents will do everything for them or the government will do everything for them. So they're not equipped to deal with reality in any meaningful way, basically.
Right, and you just transitioned to exactly what I was going to say. Kids aren't equipped in any meaningful way, and that's what MRA says as well about women, is that they're used to men taking care of them because that's a society we've built, is the idea that men are obligated to take care of women, and maybe that's why women say the adulting thing more now, because of feminism and equal rights, they have to, I don't know, take care of themselves more than they've had to before. But what you just said, Daniel, is the theme of the Adam and Dr. Drew show, reality on reality's terms. You don't have to fucking deal with reality on reality's terms if you've got somebody else running interference for you. So what becomes a big deal? Oh, posting a nice fucking meal on Instagram is a big deal when you don't have to deal with reality. Because you don't have to go out there and put in the work and add the value to the earth to create your life. Your life's already been taken care of by other people. So to you, making a meal is a big deal. Do you think I have time to snap my meals, to Instagram my meals? No, because I'm doing other shit, because I'm worrying about what I'm going to do with my life. I don't have time to think about that. But when you have other things taken care of, you can say, haha, isn't it cool? I'm adulting right now. No, I don't think I'm adulting when I'm vacuuming because I go, well, I'm making a decision whether I want my apartment to be clean or not. I'm making a decision about my life or not. That's not an adulting thing. That's me assessing reality and deciding what I want my life to be. This, when James says he's okay with it when they're 18, when they're 12, he's saying it's okay because that's growing up. And that's what growing up is. Growing up is realizing you have to deal with reality on reality's terms, and being an adult can be whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
Did I shut that down?
Yeah, get him.
Big money, no whammy, stop.
We killed this story dead. Nothing else needs to be said.
Good. So then let's move
on. It's dead. Move on.
All right. So then let's move on to The Hopeful Romantic with JML. All right, let's start out this week with this romantic section, with the entertainment section. But let's talk about Star Trek. Brian Fuller gave a pretty big interview here about what's to come in Star Trek. He said stuff like it's a 13-episode season, which is nice because that'll be a nice big arc. Because that's another thing he said, the whole season would have an arc. So a lot to be excited about here. The episodes are going to flow together. But there was one question specifically I wanted to ask you guys or not. What you thought of his answer, especially keep in mind that Brian Fuller is a gay man. So, and obviously if you've seen Hannibal, Daniel, there were a lot of gay undertones to Hannibal, correct? That's the nicest way of saying
we'll leave it.
So Collider asked Fuller this question. Star Trek has never filmed certain subject matters because it was filmed at a time when showing a gay character or showing certain kinds of characters was frowned on. What I'm so looking forward to is to see you guys be so progressive and all-inclusive. Are you looking at it that way? Fuller replied, absolutely. I think the progressive audience that loves Star Trek will be happy, and we're continuing that tradition. Now, what's interesting to me is I'm obviously not a progressive and never have been, yet I still love Star Trek and I still love Deep Space Nine, but he's right. I mean, if you look at the way the captains have progressed, you have Kirk, which, you know, the stereotypical American hero, white male, oversexed. Then you have the Picard, who's the French intellectual blowhard, old guy. Then you have the black guy in Sisko. And then you have the woman in Janeway. So are we going to see a gay or transsexual captain here? And is that an issue for Alarm if we do? Or would it even just be progressive to have a captain? An alien captain.
Didn't you forget the terrible series with the one good season?
Enterprise? It had two good seasons, seasons 3 and 4. And yes, I did forget it. Thank you for reminding me. But yeah, he was a middle-aged white dude. But that was a prequel. It was set before Kirk. But yeah, that was probably the least progressive captain, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, original Star Trek, we now sort of harp on it in modern day social justice culture as not being quote unquote progressive, but did feature a very prominent interracial kiss. And there were actually a lot of sort of really complex social issues that were dealt with on Star Trek. So
Deep Space Nine did have a less
because there wasn't. Yeah, it's not progressive by modern standards because there wasn't some trans guy, screwing a rock or an alien or something. But
right.
I think there is a huge potential here to have either an alien captain or to have a captain who is gay, trans, something. Although I have a hard time in the future. Like, is this set? When is this set? Do we know?
No details have been revealed in that way.
But nonetheless, I mean, regardless of what time in the future it is, like, the whole, wouldn't trans issues sort of be solved by then? Meaning, like, wouldn't we just have technology just like, make you into a woman if that's what you wanted to be? Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe the captain finds out he wants to be a woman during this series and then becomes a woman.
So, like, the first episode? The first episode is just him transitioning? I mean, wouldn't it take, like, 5 minutes for him to transition?
I'm getting just disgusted even talking about this. If it's a gay guy, fine. I don't even fucking care. Gay stuff and racial stuff is the least interesting part of Star Trek. I'm there to see the sci-fi issue of, like, you know, what happens if you could travel through time? What happens, you know, if you have to solve an engineering problem where you're getting sucked into a black hole? That's what I watch Star Trek for. That's what everyone else watches Star Trek for. No one cares about, you know, the Arab captain or the...
Ooh, an Islam captain. How crazy would that be?
Captain.
Woo!
You'll notice until the J.J. Abrams episodes or the J.J. Abrams Star Wars reboots of Star Trek.
Good, good.
There was no, like, Muslims anywhere in Star Trek. Actually, no, that's not true. But there wasn't a Muslim captain, at least. There wasn't an Arab captain until the J.J. Abrams. But they blew him up.
Arab's gonna go hunt his whale.
Yeah.
Which is America. His whale is America, by the way.
So many horrible jokes we could be making. But I mean, look, if they wanted to be, you know, quote unquote, genuinely progressive or controversial or cutting edge, why don't they make a gay Islamic captain?
They're not going to do that. Look, I'm going to tell you what Brian Fuller is going to do. In every series Brian Fuller has... Go ahead.
No, hold on. Here's my throwdown to Brian Fuller then. I love what he did with Hannibal, and I have optimism for what he's going to do with the Star Trek series. But if we're going to take it to the social justice-y nonsense path, then you have to do something like a gay Islamic female captain. Otherwise, you're not progressive. You're a stodgy conservative, and you should be stoned to death. There, I said it.
He might do a Muslim woman lesbian as his captain. He might, actually. That's actually a good point. He might do that because of the reasons you just said. And also, what he always does is he always has a female character on his shows with a man's name. So I would venture the captain.
God damn it.
I would venture the captain's going to be a lesbian with a man's name. It would be my guess is who the captain is going to be. If I had to place money on my Brian Fuller pool, which I am the only person who's in it, so I'm taking my own money or losing my own money, I would bet that. That's what I would bet.
Maybe her first name
Maybe her first name will be Kirk.
I'm just glad he's coming up. And do I understand? Let's talk about the part that actually matters. Do I understand correctly that this is going to be a whole new captain? It's not going to be Kirk again. It's just going to, well, we've already established that. I'm really excited about that because for years and years, I wanted to know what fucking happens after the Deep Space Nine arc and, you know, the Voyager arc. You got the fucking Borg, the Dominion, the fucking, the Romulans. The Remans, all this shit.
Yeah, but don't get too excited. Don't get too excited.
I wanted to know what happened.
Don't get too excited because...
What fucking happened?
Fuller has mentioned before it would be interesting to set a series in the J.J. Abrams verse. So it may just be in that one. So we don't know. Especially because remember, Kurtzman is producing and he wrote the Star Trek movies that J.J. directed, so it could be
so
in that universe, we don't
know.
The plots
won't make a goddamn bit of sense.
No, they'll make sense because Brian Ford is doing it.
Or will show up and he'll just be screaming the entire time.
And Brian Fuller would make that make sense, because he'd probably be being fucked in the ass by Hannibal somehow, so. All right, do we want to move on to more Star Trek talk here? So this is something I wanted to get your guys' opinion on because this just blows my fucking mind. So apparently the latest Star Trek fan film got like a lot of money on Kickstarter. There's a long history of Star Trek fan fiction and Star Trek fan productions. But apparently this got so much attention that Paramount tried to shut it down at one point. But then they softened their stance and gave like a list of criteria they had to follow in order to meet it. And one of those is it can only be half an hour long. So the director or producer of this film gave the following statement, and I want to know what you guys think of this. After a review of CBS and Paramount's announcement of their guidelines for Star Trek fan films, I'm really disappointed that this set of guidelines represents the studio's best efforts on behalf of fans. These guidelines, fuck, I didn't realize he said guidelines three times in the first three sentences. Maybe that's why they don't want you to make this shit. These guidelines appear to have been tailor-made to shut down all of the major fan productions and stifle fandom. In no way can that be seen as supportive or encouraging, which is very disheartening. While CBS and Paramount claim to want to encourage the passion of fans to produce reasonable fan fiction, the restrictions presented do just the opposite, willfully ignoring over 40 years of fans' work that helped buoy the Star Trek franchise through some very lean years and enthusiastically spread the magic of the franchise in more plentiful times. Around the franchise's 50th anniversary, we would have hoped CBS and Paramount would have taken the opportunity to unite with Star Trek fans in celebration of their creativity, not seek to crush it. And this is my fucking question about what he said. They don't have a right to make anything because they don't own it, right?
Legally speaking, correct.
So shouldn't they just fucking
the Star
be happy?
Trek name.
Shouldn't they be happy CBS is letting them do anything? Yeah.
It does seem a bit – so there's a balance here, definitely. I mean, obviously the legal side is on Paramount. Paramount owns it, right? It's on their side.
Yes,
no,
Paramount.
No question here. Morally, it's on their side. Legally, it's on their side, et cetera. But from a market perspective, they do have to be careful that if this is something that fans are really into and appreciate and is going to drive ultimately core love of the brand and core sales of the brand, that they aren't so harsh with it that's going to turn off these people. Now that's a sort of brand calculus and an accounting calculus, and it might be, look, we're crushing this, but it's only going to affect maximum 13,000 ticket sales worldwide, and that might not be worth it to care. But that's something that Paramount needs to figure out.
I mean,
that being said, yeah, this guy should stop whining.
Right. It just seems to me that now they have to indulge the entitlement of fandom, because that's what it seems like. This statement comes across as super entitled to me, like, oh, I love this, therefore I have such a big effect on it by making it. No, it's not the shit you make that people give a shit about, fucker. We're not like, hey, we're excited about Axanar. No, we're excited about Brian Fuller.
Yeah.
Yeah, and get over your fucking self. You haven't been buoying the Star Trek franchise. The fucking shows and movies have done that. They've all been good other than the Star Wars ones. Although those were good, they just weren't Star Trek movies. But, like, and their plots didn't make any goddamn sense.
Yeah, I would argue. But, you know, returning to the- Into Darkness was not good. I would argue that.
Into Darkness, they made no goddamn sense. I'm surprised. That's what I mean. The Thor was in every scene screaming in a cave. And Khan was, like, morally justified until they were like, oh, shit, we made Khan a good guy. Okay, make him, like, kill someone for no reason, and then we'll be good.
We made him a good guy and cast
him say
most...
some crazy shit.
And we made him one of the most likable actors in Hollywood. What do we do?
Yeah, right. So, get over your goddamn self. You weren't booing the Star Trek franchise. The fact that Star Trek is an amazing franchise has buoyed it and will make it so it will never go away until the culture is destroyed. Like, people, you know, the good elements of our culture are going to love Star Trek until there aren't any. So, it has nothing to do with you, you know, piggybacking off of the effort of other people. Make up your own goddamn sci-fi.
And let's have them be logically consistent here. If this is something they're doing to buoy the fan base, and they know that this is a brand that is owned by Paramount, let's have them work out a rights deal with Paramount, where Paramount gets 85% of the profits made from this movie.
Or can I make another suggestion?
How about that?
You could do like Brian Fuller did and fucking submit spec scripts to the new series Brian Fuller is working on, and start your career as a Star Trek writer, just like Brian Fuller did with Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Voyager. How does that help with buoying the franchise?
Yeah, so boo earns.
let's talk about another franchise that the fans have tried to influence, to put politely, and then there has been a major, major PR campaign going on since its release. So what I'm of course referring to, if you've listened to the Midside before, you know I'm talking about Batman versus Superman, right?
What?
And
what?
One of my major arguments about all of this moving around, like Geoff Johns gets promoted, Ben Affleck becomes executive producer, he gets a movie, is to me this has all been PR. They know what their plan is, and the plan is still working, and they still want their plan to work and believe it will work. And they don't think it's failed yet because, you know, they made almost $900 million. But the negativity has been so large that they had to pretend they were doing things to make these people feel better. They basically had to placate them. And we saw this again where a couple weeks ago, a bunch of media outlets, including, you know, Devin Fuckface, got to visit the Justice League set. And they then released a lot of different material promoting the movie, and all of it's been positive. Because, not surprisingly, on this visit, the people got to see two scenes featuring the Flash, who is apparently a comedic character. And then this is how dumb these people are, right? I'm just ranting at this point. I'll get to some quotes in a second, but I just want to rant here. They happen to go on to set the day that a Flash scene is being filmed, and then they were also shown a rough cut of a Flash scene. And then they're saying, oh, Justice League looks like it's going to be funnier and with a lighter tone. Do they not obviously realize how they were shown two funny scenes on purpose to make them feel better?
Sounds like just good studio work to me.
What's your point?
My point is these people are stupid. All right, anyway, here's some quotes I want to read. So I'm just going to read quotes now. I'm just going to read quotes now because James thinks I have no point. So here's a quote about Zack Snyder when he was asked if Justin League was going to be more fun than Batman versus Superman.
Justin League.
If I had time to write on my whiteboard, I would write that. I will write that later. All right. I actually wanted to do that, by the way. When they released the logo that looked like Daniel made it, I was like, man, I need to make this like Welcome to the Midside or Justin League. But anyway, or Justin Lesneski. Anyway, this is the way my brain works. So here's the quote. You've got to remember the whole thread of that was, and that is Batman versus Superman, to draw those two into conflict. So I wanted to make sure that each of them was, and I felt like they were both evolving in mind, and in mind anyway. I think Superman was on his way towards something that I wanted to get to a Superman that had a reason to be Superman, like a reason to feel the way he felt about humanity, that we all understand from the comic books. As far as he's pretty, as far as a moral compass goes, he's pretty much that the thing. But I feel like he had to go through something to be that. So this quote speaks volumes to me because he's basically responding with, we needed to have a story that made sense to get to the point that you guys are asking for. Isn't that what he's saying?
Yeah.
There had to be some deep conflict. There had to be some existential reason for these characters to be where they are so we could get to
them getting along,
this next phase of the story, basically.
Right. Yeah. Right. So basically he was saying,
I like this because a lot of our superhero movies lately have been about this. Think about Batman. It's the story of how he became Batman. We don't see Batman in his prime as Batman in the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. We see him building up to that level. What inspired him to do this? And a lot of these origin stories are hitting the nail right on the head in doing that.
Right.
That's why the superhero movies have become so good. They're actually deep now. They're not just about some guy, you know, shooting shit and being just sort of like normal romanticism. They're pretty deep romanticism now.
Right. And what you've just hit on, James, is a lot of what the point of Batman versus Superman was, what the theme of it was, right? Batman's arc was him finding a reason to fight again after he's been burnt out over these years, and it was Superman finding his reason to continue to fight, right? In Man of Steel, he learns to fight for individualism and freedom, but then he realizes that's not enough when the irrational culture is coming after me, so why should I fight? Oh, I should fight for the values that I see in the world and protect that value. And when we look at Deborah Snyder's quote on the theme of Justice League, I think we see that reflected. And it's interesting to me, too, that Deborah Snyder spoke, because it's sort of like she gave a lot of quotes on this tour, and I feel like she was like, Zach, I got this now. Like, this is my time to protect you. You've been doing all this awesome stuff. You don't need to deal with this. I'm going to say this stuff. So here's her quote about what Justice League is about. I think it's about the purpose of being a hero. And I think that Superman's death really did, like, have such a strong effect on Batman. And I think he really regains faith in humanity and everything that's good. Because here's this alien that just gave his life, really, for us. And I think this really changes who Batman is. And he also feels a responsibility to honor him because he didn't feel like he did it when they were living. So I think you are seeing the elevation of these heroes in this one. Now, I want to fold that quote into the synopsis. Because there's potential danger in our romance with Zack Snyder here, based on the synopsis.
A dangerous romantic romance.
Yes, exactly. Good. This is the synopsis of the movie, which, if you'll notice, echoes what the quote from Deborah Snyder that I just read said. Fueled by his restored faith in humanity and inspired by Superman's selfless act, Bruce Wayne enlists the help of his newfound ally, Diana Prince, to face an even greater enemy. Together, Batman and Wonder Woman work quickly to find and recruit a team of metahumans to stand against this newly awakened threat. But despite the formation of this unprecedented League of Heroes, Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Cyborg, and the Flash, it may already be too late to save the planet from an assault of catastrophic proportions. And the reason I say we may have trouble here is I went through a lot of effort to prove that Superman's death wasn't selfless and that it wasn't a sacrifice. That's a large argument I've made about Batman versus Superman. But then they're calling it selfless here. Is this a case of the PR and marketing team not knowing the theme of the movie? Or is this us looking for something, or me specifically looking for something in Snyder's work? Or is this Snyder just trying to placate the masses? Discuss.
This doesn't particularly bother me at this point. It might be a flag sort of thing, like I'll be on the lookout for this. But, I mean, honestly, almost all of this stuff is written by some low-level intern, and then it's passed up to a marketing director who signs off on it. I doubt Snyder saw this. Had anything to do with it, especially at this level. I mean, as we get closer to the release, Snyder will be more involved with this kind of stuff. We'll get more sign-off, but honestly, I suspect someone wrote this who doesn't completely comprehend what's going on in the universe.
So you don't think that Deborah Snyder's words were hinting at this when she says that Batman's inspired by what Superman did and his faith in humanity is regained and he feels a responsibility?
Well, remind me, did Deborah specifically say self-sacrifice or sacrificial?
No.
Well, there you go. I think Deborah and Zach
very rarely use that language if I've ever heard it in an interview or any.
They've never heard it.
Yeah.
This is the first time.
The idea of self-sacrifice is conspicuously absent from these.
Absent from everything Zack Snyder's done, which is why it raises a major red flag to see that word in the synopsis.
Right.
Yeah, but I think it raises a major red flag of a marketing intern who didn't quite get it.
Just like when the Atlas Shrugged DVDs had Selfless on the back of it.
Oh my god, Justin, try not to remind me of such things.
All right, I won't. I will remind you of other stupidity in Reddit on Reddit.
Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way, EA Glow, Steam rocks, got Respawn on Firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit, this one here is for James. James, I think you can explain this one pretty quickly. This is explain it like I'm five. Why is the AR-15 not considered an assault rifle? What makes a rifle an assault rifle? Now, before you answer, I personally think the word assault rifle is stupid because any weapon is used for assault. So, now go.
Well, I mean, I don't understand the question. It says, why is the AR-15 not considered an assault rifle? I mean, it is an assault rifle. So I don't get it. So I'll answer the second question. What makes a rifle an assault rifle? It's certain features that make it good for military applications. You're right, Justin. I don't know if the word assault is necessarily the best word to use here, but when we use the word assault rifle, it does refer to a specific concept. It doesn't mean the rifle is significantly different than perhaps like a civilian rifle or a ranch rifle. But an assault rifle is typically, here's how I would put it. It's typically a shorter range rifle for military applications made specifically for killing people. It has specific items on it made for military application. For example, a pistol grip. Think of the difference between, you know, an AK-47, you hold it on the bottom like it's a pistol. Whereas, like, think of a like a hunting rifle, there's no pistol grip. You hold the stock itself. And now there's rifles called ranch rifles that are functionally completely the same as an assault rifle. Like, they'll shoot semi-automatic, which makes them, you know, very lethal and very good for military application. But they don't necessarily have all the features that an AR-15 does that make it good for military application. You know, it's a ranch. I personally have two rifles. One is a ranch rifle, and then one is an assault rifle. One is an AR-15, and they both shoot the same bullet. They both have almost exactly the same capabilities as far as, like, the ballistics of the actual bullet. But one is a military-style rifle that's better for, you know, running, aiming quickly, shooting at short range. By the way, gunfights tend to be at short range. That's the idea, is, like, it's not these long range. It's made for, and it's specifically designed for killing people. It is in mind for kids. So there is the distinction. That is the distinction. It's a real distinction, but it gets twisted by lawmakers who try to define it as, like, okay, you can have, you know, a pistol grip, but you can't have this and you can't have that. It's a silly description when you're trying to outlaw it. But it's an apt description if you're just trying to describe it as a gun. Is this a military-style gun or a, you know, civilian-style gun? So that's the difference.
Yeah, the article gets it wrong, and I was confused about that because the article said that the distinction is basically between automatic and non-automatic. But that's not true. Something can be an assault rifle.
Not true
and
at all.
Automatic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So
you change one thing on a ranch rifle, and it becomes automatic. It's not hard.
All right.
Yeah.
So then, let's do the second and last Reddit. And this is a serious Reddit. When did your gut instinct prove to be correct? And I ask this because this seems to be anti-objectivist, going with your gut instinct.
There's a lot. So there's, when people say gut instinct, they refer to many different things, actually. So some people, when they say gut instinct, means you're just your emotional whim of the moment. But some people, when you mean gut
instinct. It could mean in a situation where they've just sort of concretized a really quick set of responses based on experiences, which is a completely fine thing to rely on. And then there's sort of a psychological component here where, like, for instance, people put in a room with someone who is a genuine sociopath, like an actual sociopath, will get a feeling of being uncomfortable, but they won't know why. So I think there are three different components here to what gut instinct can actually mean. And in some cases, gut instinct, quote unquote, can be perfectly fine to use. It can be not, it doesn't go against objectivism. And in other cases, it would radically go against objectivism. Or I shouldn't say go against objectivism. I've been trying to train myself not to do that. It would be rational or irrational is what I should say.
Yeah. And what you're saying, Daniel, that was what basically the point I was going to make about, you know, the internalization and automatizing of many things. This is something I actually share with Adam Carolla, and I think it's probably due to hypervigilance, where he often can predict things that are going to happen. Or I remember on the Dr. Drew and Adam show recently, the Adam and Dr. Drew show recently, they were talking to a woman, and like she kept giving all these answers and everything, and it, like, there was no talk about like her family history or anything. And then he just stops her and he goes, "Just answer this question. Have you been molested?" And she was like, "Yes." And like she was a little bit shocked that he was able to pick it out, because they hadn't talked about like sexual history or anything. But he's seen so many patterns that he recognizes those patterns automatically, and he sees what's going to happen. And that it comes out as an instinct because it seems automatic, when really his brain, and my brain does this too, is just making a series of assessments very quickly. You know, sometimes people are like, you know, there's no such thing as gaydar, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm pretty good at picking out who's gay and who isn't, because the way I observe people, I can internalize and automatically come up with, you know, a recognition of the pattern of their behaviors, that more often than not, that combination will be gay.
And actually, I don't know the exact numbers from the study, but you can look up, there actually been a couple studies about whether, you know, quote unquote, gaydar exists, whether people are good at it. And actually, people are remarkably accurate at picking out people, even just from like their headshots about who's going to be gay, even at intervals that are like 1/3 of a second or yeah, something, having seen the photo. They're not perfect, wow, but they're way better than you would expect. Yeah.
All right.
So, and anyway, I don't have a particular instance where my quote unquote gut instinct has been correct or not. I tend to be one of those people who, if I have a gut instinct, I will analyze it to the nth degree before I actually act on it. So maybe Fiza, this would be a better question for her, because she's, yes, much more into this. So
yes. And I think it's a good lesson to learn. We've answered the question sufficiently. We've proven my point. And it's something that I'm endeavoring more to do, is trusting my gut instinct in that sense, and my assessment of people in that sense. So I think that's good. So let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
Well, I learned that we cannot go a single episode from this point forward without discussing something with Batman versus Superman. Like, it will just be as permanent a fixture to the mid-side as Tom Brady.
Yeah, well, I mean,
we went the entire time up till now without mentioning Tom Brady.
I know, I just thought of that too. But yeah, next week we're going to talk about it too, because the Ultimate Edition is released on Amazon, so I will be watching that.
Yes, I will be too. So I learned that's a new staple, and people better get used to it. Please get used to it. Please love it. Thank you.
All right, James, what did you learn?
Well, I don't know if it's just been this episode, but just simply learning the extent of the intellectual corruption on the left and how to deal with it. You know, just even when it comes down to their daily politics, like, we're going to sit in this fucking room, and that's somehow supposed to convince you of our position on this policy issue. Just realizing that is not, and they've been doing this for years, and it's never been an argument. It was never acceptable, and it still isn't.
Yeah.
What'd you learn, Justin?
I learned that I need to elucidate my positions better.
Elysium?
No.
Your position's better?
Elysium, your position.
All right, let's chill real quick. And it's been going long, so let's chill.
Okay, chilling. If you learned something, that's awesome. Tell us at The Midside on Twitter, at The Midside on Instagram, Facebook.com/TheMidside, or TheMidside.com/podcast. Or if you really want to tell us, you can do a couple things. You can go to iTunes, search for Welcome to the Midside, scroll down past Welcome to fucking Night Vale, or whatever the other beekeeping show is. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. That's right, fuck you, Night Vale. And give us a 5-star review on iTunes. We read some of the other great 5-star reviews. You can also go to Patreon.
All
hail Patreon.
Right, and before you do Patreon, if you want the full Midside experience, you can even do the Midside on Snapchat.
What? Yes, indeed. You can see.
You have no conceptual faculty, and you're unable to follow the entire show. You can get snaps of the show, and that's pretty much just as good.
Oh, no, I don't snap during the show because I'm doing the whole video, but I just meant I snap my entire life, so.
Maybe you should, Justin.
You want to get me another iPhone, James?
Dual iPhones.
Yeah, submit to Patreon and I could have two iPhones.
Oh, go to
patreon.com/TheMidside. You can choose to give us real money, real actual Federal Reserve notes that are not real money, but that we will accept as currency per episode. You can actually give us that money per episode, and it would be awesome. It helps us keep what are we keeping?
The lights on. I got so many lights on. I got LEDs, halogens, every single different type, guys. You got to help me keep these lights on. We're running up a huge bill. Send a Patreon. Keep those fucking lights on.
Keep my light bulb from exploding again.
That's right. We need to keep the lights on. We're like Mega Man up in this bitch with Dr. Light. We have so much light that we need to keep on.
Oh, my God. My fucking pupils are like just needle points. I have so many lights. I'm dazzled by the sheer number of lights I keep on while I have this podcast. Give us money. So many lights. Patreon.
I want a new iPhone.
And then, of course, if you can't do any of that, that's perfectly fine. We still love you. You should do one thing for us, and that one thing is absolutely unequivocally, without a doubt, tell someone about the show. Tell someone. Be evangelist for the Midside. Bring other people into the Midside fold. Make new Midsiders. That's what
so
we need.
So they can talk about coming on their girlfriend's tits.
That's right. Which is
and
something
that's
that came
right.
up at my
Come
wedding,
on to
by
your girlfriend's tits. No. Ejaculate onto your girlfriend's tits. That was the word that was used.
Yes, that was the count of my wedding multiple times, by the way, which is something I apparently said on the show when talking about birth control in Africa.
It may have been screamed during my toast.
It may have been screamed during Justin's toast in front of everyone and God. So,
luckily, I exist and God doesn't. So,
lucky for you.
I'm Justin M. Wozdeski, and I hope you learned something this trip. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Yeah.
Longer pause because the website decided to reload the moment I opened it.
Fucking longer pause for welcome to the Medicide.